Good evening, everybody. Thank you so much for coming out tonight. When I drove out of our community today across the street, the beautiful saguaro had crashed into the pavement and died. And I thought, I wonder how many people are going to follow this saguaro. So I was telling Sherry that I then went back in the house and watered my saguaro, which I have never done in all these years. So anyway, a Canadian brave enough to come and see us. And Sherry, am I right that this is your first visit, or am
I? It's my first visit to Arizona.
It is?
Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah. I've been to Nevada.
Well, welcome. I think it's kind of cruel to bring a Canadian or a Brit to, you know, Arizona. We once actually had a Norwegian author who was supposed to come and see us, and the publicist looked at the temperature when it was only 100. I mean, it was just like cool, right? And she said, we have to cancel because our author will surely die.
I know.
Anyway, I'm assuming that you are all fans of Sherry Lapina's books, and therefore, I looked up some information, and I should maybe start by asking you, what's your favorite, aside from today, because you haven't read it yet, what's your favorite Sherry Lapina book? Does anybody want to volunteer? No, go one at a time. The Couple Next Door. How many Couple Next Door people here? Okay. All right. Another title? Come on. A Stranger in the House, right? Unwanted Guest. That one's a popular one, too. All right. So The Couple Next Door was a huge international bestseller, right?
It was. Sorry about this.
No, don't be silly. Crackle away.
I think, The Couple Next Door is my best known, but people often have different favorites. Some people like An Unwanted Guest because it's got that locked room thing. Different people like different ones. Yeah.
Well, you have a background that is in law and education. So based on law and education, why is it you're fascinated with crafting psychopaths? Because
yeah, maybe I'm a psychopath. I mean, I just don't know. People always ask me, you know, does law factor in at all to why I write these books? And the answer is no. I went into law because I did political science and I had good marks and I didn't know what else to do. And it was a big mistake because I hated being a lawyer and I wasn't particularly good at it. I'd always wanted to be a writer. But so I did a year of law and I said, enough, I've given it a year. I don't want to do that anymore. And decided to become an English teacher because really I like books and reading and writing. So I did that for a bit, and then I stayed home with my kids, and I started writing. So I basically did some detours and didn't start writing until I was home, and, you know, I had a bit of time on my hands, and I thought, well, I'm going to give it a go now. But I don't think, the only thing about law that might have helped was they teach you to think of everything terrible that could happen. They try to get you to imagine all the bad things that could happen, or how everything could go wrong.
Well, it's a what-if scenario.
Exactly.
I'm a lawyer, too.
Oh, and, are you? Okay.
Yeah. A librarian and a lawyer. And it's a huge asset in running a small business because, you know, your every thought is, what if? For example, the UPS strike that didn't happen, I was right on top of it.
That's the only training from law that I think was helpful to me was the, you know, what can go wrong.
Well, it also teaches you to think, you know, logically. And I found that my brain tends to travel in a linear direction, which is maybe the reason that I love police procedurals. I like to start, you know, and sort of go to the finish, and I can get derailed by twists. But you, I notice, are entirely the opposite. Well, not entirely, but anyway, you really love twists.
I do love twists. I live for twists. But I am quite linear, though. I mean, I start at the beginning, and I go right through to the end, and unlike a lot of writers of thrillers, a lot of them have, you know, dual timelines, or they'll have back and forth chapters set in different places and times, which I find, you know, I don't do that because I feel it sort of interrupts the pace of the book a little bit, which is fine if that's what you're aiming for. But mine are very linear. They go right through. I don't have a lot. I might have a little bit of flashback, but I don't have dual timelines. So I'm quite linear that way.
Well, that's a
start
good thing.
To end. Yeah.
With no spoilers at all, I will tell you that when you get to the last page and probably the last sentence of this book, you will hate her for not having actually reached a firm conclusion. Right.
I don't know.
Oh, come on.
No, come on. Like, okay, so you
we
have
can't
to play,
actually discuss it now.
You have to play fair with the reader, and you have to answer the questions. And I answer all the big questions and all of the little questions, but I do leave it a little bit open-ended at the end. Because I like to think of my characters living on after the book. You know, to me, they're alive and real.
Living on or not, as the case may be.
Or not.
Or not,
and
right.
I don't feel that life, you know, ever ends up in a nice, tidy package. And something new is always going to happen. So I like you to finish the book thinking, what's going to happen next? But at least this story, you feel that you've got it.
I'd like to think that I know what's going to happen next, but, you know, it's up in the air. So you decided to invade the medical profession to some degree in that we have a doctor behaving badly and other
yes.
hospital people behaving badly. Does that have anything to do with Canadian medicine being... or is it just...
No. No, that never occurred to me, actually. If I wanted to do Canadians behaving badly, I'd do a political thriller because our prime minister was just outed today for having an affair with the minister of culture or the minister of
foreign affairs.
And now his wife's leaving him and it's. Sorry?
Foreign affairs.
Yeah, exactly. So I should remember that.
I know.
But so I should write a political thriller, so I suppose. But no, I didn't even think about, you know, the medical profession. It just.
Got it. No, but I mean, it makes an interesting community. And partly it's because, you know, doctors are figures of authority and, you know, you think of them as kind of patriarchal and you want to trust them. And, you know, the doctor that came in to see me and said, you know, are you ready? And I thought to myself, I could still take my hand back. It's not too late. But you don't do that, right? Because you trust them too. But that doesn't necessarily mean that outside their, you know, their profession, that they are necessarily upstanding.
Oh, no. I mean, any profession, you can have a creep disguised as a doctor or a politician or anything.
Well, I don't think there's any disguise with politicians. No. At this point. I'm sorry.
What you see is what you get, I'm afraid.
Right. No. But anyway, so why don't you tell us a little bit about William? Because, you know, he's a linchpin in this story.
So William is a doctor, and he's quite handsome and quite confident, you know, a bit of a ladies' man. And he's married, and his marriage is not in the best shape, possibly because they have this daughter, Avery, who's 9 years old, and she's very challenging and difficult and has a lot of behavioral issues. And so bringing her up has created a crack in the marriage because they disagree about how to handle her. He thinks, you know, he's the doctor, he thinks that she should have more boundaries, but the boundaries don't work. She's very oppositional. The wife doesn't want to set the boundaries so much because they don't work anyway. So their marriage has been damaged by this little girl's personality being so challenging. So that marriage has started to fall apart. So he's sort of fallen in love with another woman. I'll just say a local woman at this point. And he's having an affair with her. And on the day that the book starts, she dumps him because she's afraid her family will find out. So she dumps him. And so he goes home to be alone in the house that day. And the little girl has been sent home from school for poor behavior. And she's not supposed to be home alone. She's supposed to wait at school and wait for her older brother to walk her home. So he arrives at home and she's there and he's not expecting her. And they get into an argument and he hits her really hard. And then he feels remorse and he apologizes and he says, you know, please don't tell your mother. And she doesn't agree not to tell the mother. And then he leaves. But then when he's leaving, he hesitates. And that's the end of the first chapter. So very shortly after that, the brother goes, you know, to pick up the daughter at school. She's not there. They realize she's missing. And of course, the police focus on the father because, well, they always look at the parents. But in this case, there are secrets in the family, that the family dysfunction and the fact that the father has hit the daughter on occasion. So I've set up a situation where the police are going to really look at this family very closely, and they do have some secrets that they're trying to hide. But then once they start their investigation, there are lots of other people on the street who know something or think they know something or pretend to know something about what happened to Avery that day. So as the book starts out, all I know is they think she walked home from school and was snatched off the street, but they gradually realize she was in the house and they're trying to figure out what happened after she got in the house. There's lots of suspects, lots of twists, and yeah.
Suburban snake pit, right?
Yeah, it's a nest of vipers, really.
Right.
And I can't tell you too much else about the plot, or I'll give
you. No,
you
really can't. But, you know, I think it's interesting that domestic noir has, you know, become such a big part of crime fiction. And we can go back to Gone Girl, but it existed before then. But I think it really blossomed out. And, you know, I have really mixed feelings about it, because I don't want to think that everybody close to me, my neighbors and my family, are out there to do me in, or that I can't trust them, even if real life gives you messages like that. But mine is a happy family. I, you know, love my husband and whatever. And I'm not sure what's the attraction. You know, is it sort of like, do we step out of our own functional lives and, you know, feel better about them because they're not dysfunctional? I thought it was an interesting question. You know, what is the appeal of suburban snake pit? Anybody want to volunteer? No? Oh, so you think it's really true? Oh, I'm sure you're right. Yeah.
And that's, Cece, you're exactly right.
Yeah.
So in this book, what happens is a little girl goes missing on the street, and then everybody becomes under scrutiny, right? And so think about if your neighbor was murdered or their kid went missing, and then someone, you know, police came to your house and started messing around in your family. I mean, I have nothing to hide, but I mean, you might. But, you know,
you might not write these books. No.
So, you know, it's so weird because you think that, like, these books they're all made up, right? They're all fiction. But when you read the newspaper, the stuff you read in the newspaper is so bizarre and so out there.
Lori Vallow. I mean, you could not make that up. You absolutely, you don't know who she is. Lori Vallow. I mean, it's even weirder than politics.
Now,
Yeah, this is it. Yeah.
Right. And I'm happy to say that they have convicted her. Yeah. And feels.
Oh, is this the one where the kids? She said the kids were in Hawaii or something.
Yeah.
Yes,
she's in Idaho or whatever, but she
the
still
kids
has
went missing, and she said
she still
Hawaii.
Has charges to face in Arizona. Not that they're just sort of superfluous at this point. No. Yeah. I think so.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Seriously, it's a step too far for a novelist. Yeah. Yeah.
Okay, there's nuts everywhere. And yeah, it makes this one look mild.
That's right. No, seriously. Yeah. Back to your point, right? It actually is your point, right? Indeed so.
Oh my God, did you hear that? Yeah. She said they're not really dead, they're here with us.
Yeah.
I don't know if she was trying to get into Lonely Bin instead of prison, but it's not
one. Right. Well, anyway, there are actual real stories that are as bizarre as, or more bizarre. You know, I mean, if you wrote political thrillers, you could not make up the stuff that goes on all around
us.
That's for
sure.
You know.
Yeah.
But so what drew you to? Let's go back to the couple next door. What drew you to that particular story?
Well, I wanted to write a thriller, and you know what I'm familiar with is families and people that I know, and I was able to draw on all my fears about losing my kids. And it just felt like a story that I could tell. You know, I'm not someone who... I like emotional stories. I like them to be really emotional. It's something I can identify with, and I get into my characters' heads and I try to imagine how they would feel in the situation. So they're situations that I can put myself into. Like I don't really see myself as a international woman of mystery, spy, you know, like Scarlett Johansson or anything. Like, I'm not like that, but I can think, how would a housewife feel about this? I can understand how children feel. I can understand how married men feel, even psychopaths. For some reason, I'm pretty good at getting into the heads of psychopaths. I do a lot of reading. It's just something that feels natural to me. And but the main reason is probably I'm really interested in it. I'm really interested in dysfunctional families. So if you ask me what my favorite nonfiction books are, they're usually things like The Glass Castle or, you know, the Mary Lawson book. Do you know the Liars Club? Yeah. Oh, such a brilliant book. Or, you know, Running with Scissors. All of those really, really dysfunctional families where the kids are brought up by cults or, you know, I just love that stuff. I find it fascinating. So, of course, in my fiction, I tend to write about that stuff.
I thought, you know, it was impressive that you wrote about a 9-year-old child, you know, that is a major voice in this book, and you're inside her head and inside her behavior.
She's interesting. She's challenging, but she's very bright, but she is only 9. So she makes mistakes and gets herself into a situation that, you know, a less precocious, more sensible 9-year-old wouldn't get herself into.
There you go.
Send me an email.
What, that he got to be 9? Right. So when you say, you know, she's oppositional, she doesn't actually have any kind of like neurodivergent disorder or anything, does she?
Well, I didn't want to put labels on because it creates a mess. And I did say she had ADHD.
Okay.
But I have had a bit of pushback on that because some people feel that because she had ADHD, it made people think that people with ADHD also had all these other things. But I was very careful to say, no, she has ADHD like 500 million other kids, including my 2. But she also has all these other things. So I had initially said she was diagnosed with oppositional defiant disorder. And they asked me, the sensitivity reader said, you know, please take that out. And I get it because you don't, if you have a kid with oppositional defiance disorder, it's bad enough without, you know, making it worse.
Did you just say the word sensitivity reader?
Yes.
You did.
I did.
Mm-hmm. Were you obliged to have one or did you volunteer to have one?
I was asked to have one and I didn't have a problem with it, but I took out the labels because I thought it was just going to cause problems.
This is a new thing in publishing, sensitivity readers.
Yeah. I actually have, I have an autistic kid in this one, and I actually have an autistic child.
Do you?
Yeah. And ADHD and everything. So I know difficult children. But in this one, there's a parent who points the finger at the autistic child as the possible kidnapper because he's different. And I got a complaint saying, you shouldn't treat autistic people as suspects. I'm saying, well, I was trying to show how wrong she was to point her finger at him because he was different. And I was trying to show that the mother and the autistic child had a very good relationship. And it just, anyway, it's difficult these days to not offend anybody, but it's impossible not to offend anyway. I mean, I go in with the best of intentions and I try really hard to offend no one. And I do know difficult children because I've got a difficult child. So I can't please everyone. But anyway, she's supposed to have oppositional defiance disorder, which is just someone who's super, super oppositional. And every time you give them boundaries, they just like blow right through them. Yeah, so she's difficult.
Right. I'm still having trouble with the sensitivity reader, but
well, you know, they're everywhere now, right? Everyone.
Well, I do. Right.
You all, there's a diagnosis now for everything, right? And then the experts get involved and they all have different ideas of how to treat them. So the parents get really confused about what to do. And then they, yeah.
Well, I guess my point is that you wouldn't want to point a finger at an autistic child because it was autistic. But at the same time, I don't know that you get to exempt as a suspect an autistic child right. because he's autistic.
But in this situation, it was a mother who was, you know, pointing her finger at someone because he was different for no reason.
Okay.
That's
different.
It is different. And I hope most people understand that that's what I was doing. I was trying to show that you shouldn't do that.
So where's the community that, do you have, are you vague on the geography of where the community is?
Well, it's a fictional town called Stanhope. And it's in upstate New York.
Okay.
Sort of mid-state. Yeah.
Just
along the river, Hudson River.
So if you're Canadian, do you find that American settings work better for your books? Or have you...
Well, my American publisher asked that I set it in the United States because I had originally set it in Canada, because I'm Canadian. I had set it in Toronto, and they said, you know, we would prefer it if you would set it in the States. So I did. What's that?
We have an oppositional defiant person right here in the audience.
We have quite a few psychos in Canada. Mm-hmm. Quite a few. Mm. You're probably right.
Yeah. Right. Well, I mean, I personally would love to see more books set in Canada. You know, I mean, it's our immediate neighbor north. It's a wonderful country. Love visiting it. And I don't know if all of you know, we were talking about it, that Canada is very protective of its authors and it charges tariff on books. So if we were to send a book to a Canadian customer, the post office collects $17 a book to do that. I know that because of Outlander. So, you know, the shipping charge to Canada for one Outlander book is $24, of which six is ours, or seven is ours, and the rest is Canadian. And so Canadian authors are encouraged to, you know, come into the United States and write into the United States if they want to have an American audience. And I wish that we could get rid of that and, you know, move more freely back and forth across the border with books. And I think Americans would love to read more about Canada.
So it works the other way too, like
yeah. If you're in Canada and you're shipping, there's a similar problem. So we have authors like Louise Penny and so forth. They Peter Robinson, sadly now deceased, but you know loved him. Linwood Barclay, they come down here, just like you know, like you do. Margaret Atwood is Canadian and so forth. But that's one reason that they travel so much is that. So Kevin Hearn, who used to live here and is a science fiction writer and has a big audience here, he crosses the border to a warehouse in the United States, right? Like, I can't remember, in order to do stuff. And, you know, that's, and we just had an author that moved to Victoria from Seattle, and we had to catch her on the day she was moving to get our book signed because we couldn't send them to her in Victoria.
I had no idea.
Yeah.
It's like I've been living under a rock.
Well, no, you're not a bookseller. I mean, you know, it's just one of those strange things. But I think all I'm saying is that I think that impedes our having more books that are set in Canada, which is a lovely country and has really interesting small towns and gorgeous scenery and the occasional fire, and, you know,
okay.
Whatever.
We have 1,000 wildfires going right now. 1,000.
Yeah.
That was a couple days ago.
So when you're touring the United States, do you feel like our small towns are different than your small towns? Could your small town in Upper New York be a small town outside of Toronto?
I mean, upstate New York is very similar to Ontario. It's just across the lake from us, so it feels very similar. This landscape is very different from what I'm used to.
Right.
I mean, I've never seen anything like it. I haven't been here before, and it's the desert.
So. If you were here in the spring, you would be so impressed. Didn't you? Didn't we have the most beautiful spring? We have these gorgeous trees called Palo Verde, and they're kind of like dogwoods, except they're yellow and floaty. And, I mean, it's just beautiful. And the cactus bloom. June 19th was the fatal date. It was Riley Sager's book launch here at the store. And for Riley Sager, the temperature went like, 40 degrees up or something like that. It was terrible. But really, it's just beautiful when it blooms and so forth. Right now, it's not. So it'd be nice sometime if you could come back and, when it's a knockout. Right.
Yeah.
You can have ducks in the swimming pool. We've had ducks in the pool. Did you notice the panther, was it the puma or the whatever, the mother and the babies that are living in a pool up in North Scottsdale? She's trying to keep her babies. A bobcat. It's a bobcat. Yeah, trying to keep her babies alive because in the heat and so forth. So.
Well, I just think the exploding cactuses says it all. Because up in Canada, we've been hearing about the exploding cactuses here.
Right.
With
so
pictures.
I'm able to tell you that this book is going to debut on the New York Times list next week at number 10. So congratulations to you, Sherry. That's very exciting.
Thank you very much.
And I know that because the New York Times mailed it to me today. So it's easy to tell. What are you working on or what will you be working on when you go home and recover from book
tour? Well, I've written my next one, which will be out next July.
Hoping for April.
I know all my books come out in July. That's my slot. That's where I come out. And it's always really going to be hot here. And I won't give you the title yet because we haven't really released the title. But it's set in Vermont and it's more of a rural setting. And it's quite twisty and I don't want to talk about it too much, but I'm quite happy with it.
I always think it's nice for your fans to know there's another book.
Oh yeah, there's another one. Yeah.
Yep. So questions from the audience. The thing about this book is we can hardly tell you anything about it or we're going to ruin it. I think we've gone as far. Is there anything you'd like to say about the book that wouldn't be a spoiler?
Well, there's a lot in there about different personalities and different how people react to each other and how they relate to one another. And there might be the odd psychopath in there. And everybody's got secrets and it's quite tense. It's quite tense as the secrets unfold and the police apply pressure and the families start to disintegrate and suspect each other.
She says gleefully.
I find it quite fun.
Right.
I do.
Yeah.
I just make it up, right? I mean, it's... Well... Yeah. Well, I live on a farm, so I don't go to that many coffee shops and drop in on people, eavesdrop on people. But I do read the news. I get a lot of ideas from the news, like just a little kernel of an idea. Like one of my books starts off with, it was spurred by an idea I read online about if you park your car in a snowbank and you plug the exhaust pipe with snow and you put your wife in it and your child in it and you shovel out for 20 minutes, they'll die. So it's a really good way to kill your family because you don't need an alibi. You don't have to get rid of the bodies and everybody will assume it was an accident. So that I thought that's a great way to kill your family. And I thought I can use that in a book. And so I did. So I thought, I started off in the prologue with this pregnant woman dying of carbon monoxide poisoning. And oh, it's a terrible accident. And then I had, he remarried and then the second wife finds out about this. And the whole book is about, did he really kill it? Like, was it an accident or not? So that came from reading the news. Sometimes it's just I have an idea of a relationship that I want to explore. So this was the case with this book where I wanted to have a difficult child and a father who has a bad interaction with her. So that was the idea for that one. But I pull little bits from some true crime things sometimes. You know, it's like one of my books was started off. It was someone we know, and it was an idea about a teenager who sneaks into people's houses and breaks into their computers. And that was inspired because I read something online about a teenage boy whose parents cut off his Wi-Fi at night because he was on the computer too much. And at this point, mine was on the computer too much. And so he broke into the neighbor's house just to use their Wi-Fi in the middle of the night. And I thought, yeah, I can see my teenager doing that. Like, that is completely plausible. So I like to do things that are plausible but can lead to something else, right? So
You a reader of Linwood Barclay?
I love Linwood. I've read all his books.
Well, because he does, I mean, there's some similarities there, you know.
The same agent, we're good friends,
right? Oh, he's a wonderful guy. And we've done many book events with Linwood. He was actually a writer in residence here a while back, right, escaping from the winter. And so was Ian Hamilton, who you may also...
I've met Ian Hamilton, but I don't know him very well.
But anyway, Linwood is sort of the same thing. I thought his book, Elevator Pitch, was absolutely a knockout.
He has the best high-concept ideas. Like, he has really good hook high-concept ideas.
Elevator Pitch, the elevator was the instrument of death. Right. But what I learned from that, I mean, because he also does a lot of research, and I think I love crime fiction because you get to learn stuff that would otherwise almost never come your way, that they are working on smart elevators. So it reads your face. It's a facial recognition thing. So when you show up and press the button, it recognizes you, and then it will take you to, you know, your destination. I was thinking that the Mayo Clinic, where I've been a habitué lately while we've been going through this, could really do that. You know, it would be an interesting thing for them to do because, A, they have, you know, it would be a way to sort of control
people coming in. I find facial recognition quite scary.
It really is.
I was in Beijing the first time I saw it, and it is everywhere. And I thought, oh, I feel like I'm living in Orwell's police state.
But I'm not sure I want an elevator to be that personal.
No, you know, no, I have enough trouble with the card, you know, getting the card to light green so that I can press the button to go up the...
Last time I flew to Egypt, right? Well, anyway, last time I did fly to Egypt with Dana Stabenow on a research trip, when you boarded the Lufthansa flight, they didn't bother with a passport or a ticket or anything. It was facial recognition. You just smiled at the... You know, you're at LAX and you smile at it and it goes, yes, and you depart for the plane. I thought it was really creepy. I'm used to paper. You know, I don't know quite what to do without it.
Wow.
I know. It's coming. I mean, I think more and more that we will see that. So
what if you have a terrible accident and you smash your face?
Well, that's a...
I shouldn't think this way.
I was just going to say that there have been two or three thrillers where, taking that into account, people have had remarkable plastic surgery.
Well, the mob people do, right?
Yeah.
I think they get a new
But
face.
You know, the one thing you can't all talk about digression. We're really going to digress. The one thing you can't alter, plastic surgery or anything, is the way you walk. And they can always get you from your gait because every person has a distinctive walking pattern. Yeah, and that's what they are actually really using now, much more than facial recognition. No doctor can really adjust your whole body so you walk differently.
Oh my. I'm just thinking right. That's so interesting.
Right.
It affects their gait.
Yeah. See, there are plots everywhere.
There are ideas everywhere.
And it just takes the kind of mind like Sherry's that goes, what if? You know?
Twisted. Absolutely. So yeah, you just start with one idea and it just leads to...
Yeah. Do you have sort of like a file, you know, of sticky notes or ideas or something?
Sadly, no. I find coming up with ideas a little bit difficult, you know, just because it has, you know, it's hard to come up with an original idea because there's so many books now, so many crime books, and it's so hard to do a murder in an interesting way. So it takes me a while to light on something that I think I can work with and, you know, and I never have the whole book. I just start with an idea and it has to grab me enough that, you know,
and then
I can
things
run with
kind
it.
Of stick to it as you move along.
Yeah.
Do you ever go down a path and then have to back up?
Virtually never. The only time I've ever had to do that was with an unwanted guest when I got myself into a corner, because it's one of those locked room mysteries, and I was just stuck. Because, you know, you had to have people in different places and people had to know. I just was stuck. And then I realized the problem was I'd killed the wrong person first. So when I killed her, so I went back and I killed a particular woman.
So you revived her and killed somebody else?
By putting her down the stairs. What's that?
I said you revived her and killed somebody else?
No, I had to delete some stuff. And then instead of killing somebody with a knife in the library, or whatever it was, I don't remember. Yeah. I had her get pushed down the stairs and then smashing her into the corner of the stairs. I don't know. I have all this rage. I don't know. All this unexpressed rage, because I really enjoyed the... I didn't want to just push her down the stairs, because I wanted it to, like... Yeah, I wanted it to look like an accident. But then the doctor thought, no, it wasn't a doctor. He was a lawyer. Anyway, he thought, no, it looks like she'd had her head smashed against the... Now, I know people who've died in falling downstairs accidents. Did you guys see The Staircase? Talk about fun true crime. That, do you know The Staircase? Oh, that was a good one. You know that one, right? I think he did it. Okay, so there's this guy, and his wife fell down the stairs, and he was tried for murder, and he got away with it, I think. Yeah. And then the appeal. No, he didn't get away with it, and then he appealed, and he did get away with it. I can't remember. But the thing is, another woman had died in the same way that he knew 10 years earlier in Germany. So, you know, that was a bit weird. But also, they had this strange theory of an owl attacked her head. Like, because she had all these, you know, it looked like she'd been beaten and then pushed down the stairs. But they had some theory about some owl had gotten in the house and smacked her about the head. And anyway, he's a crime writer. You might know him. What's his name? I can't remember. But he wrote thrillers.
Yeah.
Yeah, military thrillers. What's his name?
You know, the trouble with murderers who go back to the well too often is that it's like, you know, Crippen and the wives in the bath. If he just drowned one, he probably could have gotten away with it, but his mistake
was buried his method.
Yeah, exactly. You know, try some other, going back to the bathtub just was, you know, like, hello.
This guy shouldn't use the staircase anymore.
Right. Note to murderer, vary your technique, whatever it might happen to be. Another question from anybody? Yes.
Yeah.
So what is your favorite book that you've written?
Oh, I don't think I have a favorite. And that's true. I just don't. I mean, my favorite book probably is The Couple Next Door, because it changed my life. But I don't think that's my best book. I don't know what's my best book. I think this might be my best book. A lot of people are telling me that. I don't know. They're all different. I don't really have a favorite, you know?
It's probably the one you're writing now, because it's still perfect.
Yeah, it's always, I always like the one I'm working on. And then when I work on it too much, I start to hate it. So I need some distance before I like it again. But that's just because I'm working too hard and I get tired of it. It's like working on an essay for
too
long.
You had a question back there?
I'm a pure pantser. I never know the ending. I don't even know who the characters are going to be, except the first two or three. Yeah. Like for Not a Happy Family, I knew it was going to be an older couple that was rich that was killed and they would have kids, but I wasn't sure how many kids. Yeah, I just like the idea of kids killing their parents for money. Like I said, the more dysfunctional the family, the better. You should all read The Glass Castle. Have you had her in here?
No.
Jeanette? Well, okay.
All right. Patrick, do you have a question or two from the audience?
I do, yeah. Let's see here. There's a question about the title of this book and of all your books. Do you get to pick the titles? Was this your original title for this book?
The only title I ever did was The Couple Next Door. And then it's my team. We all work for months trying to come up with the right title. It's way harder than you might think. So it's my British editor, Sarah Adams, that came up with Everyone Here is Lying, which we thought was a perfect thriller title. Could not believe nobody had used it. So I come up with titles all the time, and I Google them, and there's like three books with that title. So titles are very hard because they have to sound a certain way, and a lot of them are taken. You'd be surprised how.
Well, but it really doesn't matter if they're taken because you can't copyright a title.
No, you can't.
But you don't want somebody to mistake it.
You don't want to confuse it. Yeah. Yeah.
Right. What was the girl on the train and somebody had a title that was like just one word off? The girl on the train, anyway, became a bestseller by accident because people would click on the wrong thing when they went to buy The Girl on the Train. And it was like the girl took the, I mean, it was hilarious.
Yeah, but you wouldn't want that to happen to you. And then you get all these one star reviews on your book. And they read a
That's
different book
true.
With the same
right.
title. Mm-hmm. Actually, there is another book called The Couple Next Door. It was a gay porn book. And we thought, and it was self-published. We thought, that's not going to hurt me. No one's going to. So, yeah. Yeah, titles are hard, for sure.
Let's see. Another question that's come in. Do you have any interest in writing a series at some point?
I would be interested if I could think of the right idea for it, because I'm not really a police procedural writer. I focus more on the people involved in the crime, and the police are sort of there to come in and exert pressure on people. But so I don't want to do a detective series. But if I could think of something that's a bit different, yeah, I wouldn't mind, because it would be nice to have some of it already created.
Right, because otherwise you're doing world building with every book.
With every book, yeah.
Yeah, because you have to, I mean, at least when you have a series, you've, you know, laid the groundwork. On the other hand, once you've laid the groundwork in a series, you can't go back and fix it, you know, because you want to do something different. So it's a plus and minus kind of a thing.
That's true, yeah.
Let's see. Renee would like to know, how old were you when you realized that you wanted to be an author?
I was 9. I knew at 9 I wanted to be a writer, and I was obsessed with Nancy Drew, and I wanted to write Nancy Drew books. And I thought that would be the perfect life. And I loved Carolyn Keene, and I thought, oh, I want to meet Carolyn Keene. And it wasn't until much later that I realized that Carolyn Keene wasn't a real person. There was a whole bunch of Carolyn Keenes. But yeah, that I thought that would be the perfect life, because, you know, what could be better than writing fun mysteries? But I didn't think it was very practical, so I put it off for a long time. But I knew at 9. So I tell people, what did you want to do when you were 9? Maybe that's what you should do. But
are there any topics that are off limits to you?
Like for me to write in?
For you to write about, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I have my own lines I don't like to cross. I wouldn't do child pornography or... I'm not a graphic crime writer. I mean, I sound like I am about smashing the head against the stair, but most of my books, they're really about the anticipation and the psychological suspense. There's not a lot of graphic violence in them, so I stay away from...
I don't think domestic horror in general goes in for the bloody and the...
No.
It's much more
about
of a mental
suspense.
Psychological yeah. kind of a thing. I mean, people die, and it's not like a cozy where, you know, it's tidy, but...
It's between a cozy and one of those Joan Espo books, you know, the really violent.
No hold bars, no, right?
Yeah.
Joe was here. When was it? June, wasn't it, Patrick?
Yeah.
He's a dark guy, no question.
It's very dark, yeah.
Many of those Scandinavian guys are seriously
they don't get enough
noir.
Sunlight. You know, maybe they should come here and brave the heat.
Anything else, Patrick?
Does anybody here have questions?
Right. Oh, sorry. Yes, sir.
I am, and I'm not reading as much as I would like or as much as people might think, because I just don't have time. So I probably read, I'd say maybe a book a week, maybe not even. Okay, so
that's
I'm actually a really slow reader too, and I mean some people read a book a day. I don't know how they have the time, but well, I think some people if they're not worth their retired, they're not working, whatever, a book a week, you know, I can do. So how many books do you read?
About 3 a day.
And still at a bookstore. Wow.
It only takes me about an hour and a half to read a book.
See, I'm a slow reader. I'm a slow reader,
super
like
fast
you.
Reader. I had a truly agonizing moment the other day when I was waiting for the cast people to take off my cast, and there were several sort of unemployed hospital nurses people there at Mayo, and one of them was talking about her goal, she said, was to read a book this year.
Oh dear.
And then she said, but realistically, she said, it will take me 2 years to read a book. And, you know, it was really hard for me to sit there. But absolutely. And you know what? If you're a slow reader, that's fine. You know, I mean, it's
yeah, there's nothing wrong with being
I'm a freaky thing. But, you know, I also point out some people have perfect pitch. And some people can draw a perfect circle. You know, all of us come however we come. My mother was like that. And so clearly it's something that either I inherited or I learned from her or whatever it is, you know. But I've always been, until I had a bookstore, I never had enough books. It was awful. I was like, you know, hanging out at the library at the use, whatever. Now, of course, if you saw my office, it'd be a real job. Patrick will tell you, I leave the store almost every day with a whole mail tub full of new reading copies that come in. And it's totally out of control at this point. I read today, I can't remember in what publication, that said that this week, 288 new adult fiction books are publishing and 1,360 nonfiction books are publishing this week, August 1st. Now, I'm serious, 288 adult fiction and 1,300 or 60, whatever it was, nonfiction. And it's getting more so. So there is really no way at this point to keep up. So I've been trying to kind of narrow down the books that I present to you because, you know, it's so overwhelming. You can't sift through all of that. I can do it better than you can because I read faster, but that doesn't mean that my taste is going to be your taste. So I try to, you know, and Patrick is a great reader, but, you know, he has a different taste. But, yeah, I mean, don't you think the volume is just overwhelming at this point?
Absolutely, yeah. How much of that stuff, though, is kind of self-published, or does that include?
I don't know. I was just looking at a gross figure. I mean, I didn't pursue. I was so depressed when I read it. I didn't go any further to
You're
see.
You're depressed. I'm depressed.
How, you know, but the thing is that their avenues to publishing are so more varied now. There's all kinds of self-publishing. There are little tiny, you know, operations, which I think is a good thing. Because otherwise, you know, the consolidation of major publishers has made it harder. But they're just, it's like mushrooms, you know, just everywhere, which means there are more and more books that are coming out. So.
Yeah, so don't feel you have to read them all.
No.
I read a lot of books within my genre.
Sure.
But then I try to read outside as well. But yeah, it's just hard finding the time. And when I'm writing, I don't necessarily want to be reading in that genre, so I'll want to read something different. Like, I like shipwreck stories.
Sure.
I love those.
One reason author events are fun is the discovery element. You know, you can come down here and find out stuff that you wouldn't have run across in your ordinary, you know, and then go home with a different book. I'm going to give you a book that you might not have read. One person here will get a book when we leave tonight. Skillian McAllister's new book, Just Another Missing Person. Really interesting book. Right, Patrick.
So getting back to the staircase.
wrenching us
back. What's your take on the owl theory? I find that kind of charming.
I'm not buying the owl thing.
You're not buying the owl?
I can't get sued if I say I think he did it.
No.
I have no opinion.
You have no opinion that you think he did it? I'm kind of on the same. Yeah.
What do you guys all think?
What is the owl theory? I'm missing the owl theory.
I'm trying to explain why she had all these smashes on her head, and they said it's because
an owl rooted on her head.
Because there was blood everywhere, and she fell down the stairs, and it was just unlikely there would be a bloodbath at the bottom.
How did
the
owl, which is a large bird, how did the owl get in the house?
Well, you know,
the door was open.
Owls don't do that.
The door was open. To the pool.
I don't know, a bird of prey or some sort. I kind of like the theory.
You know the case, right?
Yeah.
What's your opinion on it?
I don't know. I mean,
don't know. I mean, obviously,
I don't
know. It's
pretty amusing when they're trying to kind of recreate what happened. They're like, okay, so she fell, and then she like hit her head like 5 times, and it's like, boom, and then she fell again. It was like, turns into like a Keystone Cops skit with her hitting her head like 10 times. But
defense attorneys are nothing if not creative.
Oh, man.
We're about to see some really astonishing creative defense theories coming our way.
There are a couple more questions here. Sorry, people on YouTube, I don't mean to neglect you. Sherry asks, do you read your reviews? She says she just listened to the new book on audio and absolutely loved it.
I do read my reviews in most places. Like, I read them in the, you know, the ones in the newspapers and so on. And I read all the ones on my Instagram. And the only ones I don't read the Amazon ones and I don't read the Goodreads ones because I don't know how to get into Goodreads. And
listen, that's become a political hotbed.
I don't know how to get
it
in.
It really has. Yeah, no, you can just do Goodreads.com, but Goodreads has become a real hotspot about flash mob kinds of things, you know, people trolling books and putting up bad reviews and, you know, all this other stuff.
I don't do Goodreads and I don't do Amazon and I don't have time to go scrolling through all that stuff. So, yeah.
A lot of the Amazon reviews are, you know, book did not arrive in a timely fashion, you know, that kind of stuff. Okay, so maybe a final question.
We have a question over here, I think, too.
Oh, I'm sorry. Yep.
Yeah. Do I have a favorite? Not really. Well, okay, maybe. I in Stranger in the House, I really liked Bridget. I really liked Bridget. And then I got an email from Bridget. Bridget Cruikshank. I don't know. I just, something about her. I just really thought she was really creepy. So ever since I got an email from her, I Google all my character names before I send the book in. So that I don't use the name of a real person because I always hear from them.
It's almost impossible. I mean, you know, if you do, like I do the store Instagram and you do the hashtag thing and you put, there are like 80 people that are all called, you know, Sherry Lapena. Seriously.
There's no other Sherry Lapena.
No, but it's really astonishing how many Spencer Quinn. Yeah. I didn't think I was doing a post because he was here the other day. Mm-hmm. And I thought, how many Spencer Quinns can there possibly be? And then, you know, there were like scrolls of them.
Yeah, it's true. It's true. Yeah.
You know, somebody told me that they use old election rolls in the UK as a way to try to find names that, you know, all kinds of things. What do?
I Google popular names. Like, I just read a book set in Vermont. So I look at the most popular names in Vermont, and you can go hundreds down. And for the year of birth for each of the characters, so that they're time appropriate, because my daughter pointed out that, you know, Mom, nobody 13 would have a name like, you know, Ella these days. You know, she's just this, well, thank you. Okay, thanks. But anyway, names have a way of seeming dated or you know, just
well,
not.
They're definitely, you know, names have fads or popular. Yeah, I mean, exactly. Look at all the flower names that were Victorian, for example.
Right.
You know, as an
So I look up names that way, and then I put a first name and a last name together, and then I Google it to make sure that nobody has that name.
Do you have any, I always find this interesting, are there names that have any kind of emotional freight for you? I mean, do you know, I have a man's name that I'm not going to repeat it, that I just hate. And I have no idea why. I must have known him somewhere or other.
Tell us
whenever,
what it is.
No, I'm not going to. But whenever I read a book and this name pops up, I go, ah. And, you know, but I think a lot of us associate
things with certain names.
Yeah, exactly. There's an emotional content, you know, that can. The other thing you have to be careful of as an author is you can't have the names sound alike. So you can't have
start with the same letter.
Yeah, Jack and John and Jim or Jack Jr. or something, you know, in one book is really, really confusing to readers. So, right. All right. Final question. Anybody have one? No? We're all worn out. We've done our digressions as usual. This is what happens. We can't really talk about the book in depth, right? It's all your fault.
Yeah.
Right. So thank you very much for coming. And hello. We hope you're enjoying our programs and podcasts with authors. We'd like to expand them, and your help would be appreciated. please make a donation at poisonedpenfoundation.org. 100% of the proceeds will go to help connect authors with readers in this difficult time. Thank you.